Breaking a major taboo in Thailand, protesters in the streets of Bangkok are calling to limit the power of the monarchy.
It is already a big, big change. People can talk about the monarchy. People can go on the street again. This is huge.
I'm Marco Werman. In the presidential election, gay rights haven't been discussed much. LGBTQ activists say the U.S. has fallen behind and needs to become a global leader.
How you treat people abroad is often how you treat people here at home.
And in Mexico, even the coronavirus can't keep wrestling fans away.
There's nothing impossible for the Mexicans.
Clever ways to conjure up normalcy during a pandemic. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. We begin the show today in Afghanistan, where the Taliban is on the offensive. For 5 days now, Taliban militants have been clashing with Afghan security forces in Helmand province. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following the story. Shirin, what's driving this new round of fighting?
Marco, it's unclear what exactly is driving these clashes, but what we know is that in the past few months, the Taliban has been using violence to strengthen its position at the negotiating table. As we've reported on the show before, the Taliban is meeting with Afghan representatives in Doha, in Qatar, and they're working to come up with an agreement to end the war in Afghanistan. And all this is being pushed by the Trump administration, who wants to end its involvement in Afghanistan and to get American troops out of the country.
Right. So how are these clashes then different from what we've seen in the past few months in Afghanistan?
Marco, this is the biggest offensive that the Taliban has carried out in recent months. Since the negotiations began last year, the U.S. military stopped its aerial bombardments against the group, but this latest offensive has forced them to carry out some targeted attacks again. The Taliban is trying to take over the province's capital called Lashkar Gah. And there are videos coming out of the city that shows thousands of people, families, children, elderly, fleeing their homes. In this video, several people are riding on a motorbike. They're clinging onto each other as they're leaving town. It just goes to show you how desperate people are to get out of the city. Marco, this is Kahkashan Kufi. She posted online that she has lost a friend in these fightings. And I reached out to see who this friend is. And she told me that his name was Obaid Ahmadi and he was 31 years old. He worked in the Afghan Air Force and he was killed when his helicopter crashed in an accident last night. And she said, this is just yet another example of how Afghans are losing their lives in this senseless war that's been going on for decades.
Yeah, it is really hard to hear. You know, Shirin, what's surprising to me and the big question I have is that all this violence is happening while there are peace negotiations going on in Doha, as you said. Why does the Taliban continue fighting as it's discussing peace with the Afghan government?
Marco, I've been trying to reach the Taliban officials to ask them that question, but they haven't responded yet. The U.S. military commander in Afghanistan, General Scott Miller, has said that the assault is not consistent with the U.S.-Taliban agreement and that it undermines the ongoing peace talks. But I should also mention something that happened right before this offensive began. Last week, President Trump tweeted that he wants to bring all American troops home by Christmas. That comment is inconsistent with what the U.S. agreed with the Taliban, which is that American troops will withdraw in phases and only if the Taliban meets the requirements that are stated in the deal. Later, military officials in the Trump administration sort of distanced themselves from the president's comment. But some analysts are saying that this tweet might have emboldened the Taliban to carry out this type of attack.
So where do the peace talks in Doha stand at this point?
Well, it seems like they have stalled. The two sides have spent weeks trying to figure out the rules for the negotiations. And honestly, progress has been super slow, Marco. The Taliban hasn't agreed to a ceasefire, which is why we are seeing the fighting continue. And even the fighting has intensified during these talks. So it's a really long and painful road, these negotiations.
Yeah, sadly, that doesn't sound very promising toward peace. We'll keep following along with you, Shirin. The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome, Marco.
In Bangkok, thousands of protesters have been doing the unthinkable today. They're confronting their king. This is an illegal act in Thailand. Pro-democracy activists line the streets today along the route of King Maha Vajiralongkorn's motorcade. The king spends much of his time abroad, but he is back in Thailand for a few weeks. Tongchai Winichikul has been following today's protests and the movement behind them that's been energized since this summer. Tongchai is a historian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What kinds of reforms are protesters demanding?
They prefer the king to be beyond politics, to behave strictly under the constitution, because unlike many other countries which have monarchies, Thai monarchies do have mechanism and have ways to interfere and to have power or influence over political operation. The king can amend the constitution, which have gone through the referendum by people already. The king can demand to have control over the two regiments, army regiments in Bangkok. The king can demand for the law to transfer all the wealth of the crown, which is not his personal wealth, to become his personal wealth. These are the things that people cannot accept. But people have been grumble, gossip, and talk about for a long time. I don't mean everybody in Thai, of course. There's a lot of royalists, but a lot more who have not been satisfied.
We should point out that criticism of the monarchy in Thailand is punishable with jail time. So protesters are risking a lot to be in the streets. It would seem to be really unusual to see public criticism of the monarchy this way in Thailand, is it?
Yes, of course. But at the same time, that law has been a subject of criticism for quite a long while, at least in the past decade. Even people who call for the reform or for the men of that law in particular, not the monarchy as a whole, was arrested for that law as well, which is crazy. The court and the police has been interpreted unreasonably. The process is not due process. Even doing little things such as sharing the BBC news can violate the law. Depends on what the court decides. So a lot of people are not satisfied with this interpretation, with this stretch of interpretation.
At the demonstrations today, there were also many counter-protesters in support of the monarchy. And even among pro-democracy activists who are protesting, they are not, I understand, demanding the end to the monarchy. Is that right?
No. Collectively, their demand is that reform meaning such and such and such in order for the monarchy to survive, to last for a long time without much criticism as it has received in recent years.
You can obviously see that many of the leaders in this protest movement are students, and there is a long history of student activism in Thailand. You were arrested, in fact, as a young student activist in Bangkok in the 1970s. So what do you see when you look at these young student leaders today?
They are smarter. They are well-informed. Of course, it doesn't mean that in my time we are not smart, but in terms of well-informed, this time they are much better informed. But another thing is that social media make a lot of differences. The social media not only change the ways they communicate, the way they organize, the way they inform the public, but at the same time, social media is beyond control of the government.
This latest wave of protest, Tongchai, it's been going on since the summer. Where do you see them going from here? Is this the beginning of a new era in Thailand?
It is already a big, big change. People can talk about the monarchy. People can go on the street again. This is huge. This is huge. But how long it will go? What would the government respond? It's hard to say. For me, I think it's hard to say. But big change already happened.
Tongchai Winichikul, a historian and professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, thank you very much for your explanations.
Thank you.
The southern Mexican state of Oaxaca is known for high-quality artisanship, especially when it comes to textiles. It is a cottage industry, though, and the pandemic has hit it hard. Tourism has ground to a halt, and when that trickles down to the local economy, it means lots of things are also on hold. The economy is frozen. but there is one small piece of rectangular cloth that is in high demand these days, and artisans in Oaxaca are adapting their businesses to stay afloat. Shannon Young has our story from Oaxaca.
The rhythmic sounds of looms fill the air in the Oaxaca City suburb of Pueblo Nuevo. The neighborhood is home to multiple small-scale textile workshops, employing approximately 150 people who weave items by hand. Álvaro López Jiménez founded the neighborhood's first textile workshop with his brothers 25 years ago. They make cotton bedspreads, tablecloths, placemats, curtains, and shawls. Their clients include hotels and restaurants and handcraft shops that resell their products in tourist hubs like Cancun and Puerto Vallarta. The family also sells directly to customers in handcraft expos, or at least used to.
En esta última, pues, nos fue mal.
López Jiménez says his brother José went to a big expo in another state in mid-March and returned without having sold a single item. Then clients began canceling large pending orders. It was then they realized they needed to adapt.
¿Qué vamos a hacer? Vamos a crear cubrebocas.
The workshop started making face masks with hand-woven cotton, López Jiménez says. They sold their first batch to the state government. Then local hospital workers started buying them. They've since sold 3,000 face masks. López Jiménez says those sales allowed his family to retain all 30 of their employees, although at reduced hours. It's a shift fashion designer Gabriela Iturribarria has also made. She rents a storefront in downtown Oaxaca City. Her work features traditional fabrics and regional embroidery designs on modern formal wear.
De hecho, son vestidos realizados para 15 años, para fiestas.
Iturribarria says the dresses are mostly for special occasions, like 15 años parties, weddings, and other ceremonies. But those events are on hold now, and sales have plummeted.
Pues tuvimos que adaptarnos a realizar lo que son cubrebocas.
Iturribarria says what's kept her business afloat are face masks featuring the same traditional textiles and embroidery motifs used in her dress designs. Her masks sell mostly to local buyers for between $2 and $3 each. It's been a struggle. She had to close her shop for 2 months, then move to a place with cheaper rent. Handmade masks are now bestsellers in local textile shops, where they often occupy the most prominent street-facing displays. Some Oaxacan artisans tap relatives in the U.S. to help sell their masks online or through in-person contacts. Self-employed artisans have received virtually no aid from the Mexican government. So one organization has stepped up, the Alfredo Harpelú Foundation of Oaxaca, which runs Mexico's only textile museum.
Decidimos dentro de este equipo de arte popular.
Eric Chavez is the coordinator of the foundation's popular arts program. He says they created an emergency grant fund at the start of the pandemic to support new work by Oaxacan artisans.
Actualmente estamos llegando a 14 estados.
Chavez says they've actually expanded the program, commissioning nearly $500,000 worth of work from more than 1,600 artisans across Mexico. Textile artists have gotten the most support, but the program also helps out artisans who aren't set up to make masks. During the pandemic, even exceptionally well-made handcrafts can be hard to sell. Unless, that is, they can be worn on your face to prevent contagion. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Protesters in Nigeria have forced government officials to disband a rogue security force, but violence from security forces continues. And so do the protests.
What they're actually saying is that they need the government to step in and address the culture of police brutality that has cost a lot of lives.
That's coming up next on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. In many streets across Nigeria, anger is boiling over. Thousands of protesters are turning out in several major cities, demanding reform of the country's police forces, notorious for kidnappings, harassment, and extortion. Nigerian security forces have killed at least 10 of the demonstrators. Amara Wampa is among the protesters in Abuja, Nigeria's capital. He directs the public policy initiative there. I asked him what the protesters have managed to accomplish.
They've gone to the National Assembly, they've gone to the police headquarters, What I've witnessed is that police has been very violent with them over the past few days. They've been shot at. They've been pelted with hot water cannons and with tear gas as well.
There are demonstrations taking place in Abuja, where you are, and in cities and towns across the country, big cities like Lagos. Let's hear this. This was a scene this week in Abuja, the capital, where you are.
Move forward!
So, Amara, was that live ammunition the police were firing just a moment ago?
Yes, they were firing live ammunition, yes. Not rubber bullets. Live ammunition has been fired.
So this is happening this week after Nigeria's government announced it was disbanding the infamous police unit that a lot of people are upset by. It goes by the acronym SARS. That's a special anti-robbery squad. It's disbanded, and yet the public's anger is still really boiling over. Explain that.
The Nigerian police brutality is actually a culture. Nigeria inherited this police force from its colonial past. The police has largely seen its role in society as protecting the state from the citizen or protecting the political elite from citizens. And so that has largely carried on over the last 77 years. Where we find ourselves right now is that over the past two decades, the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, SARS, has become notorious for brutality, extortion, extrajudicial killing, and targeted harassment of young people. And so when young people say, end SARS, I don't think they were expecting their government to take them too literally and just disband a unit of the police force. What they were actually saying is that they need the government to step in and address with concrete measures the culture of police brutality that has cost a lot of lives. And while the government was busy announcing the dissolution of the unit, policemen across the country were shooting at peaceful protesters. And so young people are saying to the government that nothing really has changed.
So while the government disbanded the special anti-robbery squad, it sounds like things have only gotten worse. So now what?
Even though government has announced several measures, including recalling all the officers in the units back to Abuja for retraining and psychological testing, what young people are asking for and what they're looking for is something that makes a difference in their lives, that makes them safer when they go out in the streets about their business.
Yeah, tell us more about the culture of impunity that's really been associated with Nigeria's police and how that plays into this current controversy over the special anti-robbery police.
Okay, so Nigeria maintains a national police force, and that police force is over-centralized. So Nigeria is a very big country, but you have a national police force that has a single head. And so it's notoriously difficult to manage. It's over-centralized, it's under-resourced, it's ill-equipped, and too often it suffers from political interference. The recruitment process has been compromised. The officers are poorly trained. They're also badly paid. And so a lot of time, you know, they're prone to corruption and violence. And a lot of officers who, find out that they don't have the capacity and they don't even have the resources to ensure public safety, they've turned to crime. And so the Nigerian police force relies on torture to elicit confessions. People are being profiled on the streets and treated as criminals when they are not. And they're just regular young people going about their business.
Yeah, and all sorts of people have been protesting in the streets and online. People are posting videos of police brutality and voicing their concerns. There's a hashtag now, End Police Brutality in Nigeria. Here's the well-known musician, Femi Kuti, who posted this video on Twitter.
The police have the authorization to shoot innocent protesters on the streets. What is happening on the streets of Nigeria right now is unacceptable, and every police officer must be held accountable, and the government must be held accountable for every life lost. This is a peaceful protest. The police are meant to protect life and property. The police are meant to defend the citizens of this country, not kill its citizens.
So, Amara, what are the obstacles right now to reform, and what's it going to take to re-envision the role of police in Nigerian society? That sounds like a big question.
It will start, first of all, by holding officers accountable. And so for these cases that have been reported, where there have been individuals have been killed or tortured and they've made reports, officers need to be punished and justice needs to be done. And those victims need to be acknowledged and they need to receive the appropriate judicial remedies for what they've gone through. And then the police has to be a lot more transparent about the transformation it's going through, the reform. So the police has to be more open, more accountable. There's a role that the National Assembly or the legislature has to play in this situation, you know, basically to pass laws that allow for reliable, independent oversight of the police, and perhaps even restructuring of the police to reduce the over-centralization of the force, to make it easy for administration and accountability.
Amara Wangpa is based in Abuja, Nigeria's capital, where he directs the Public Policy Initiative. Amara, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I have a music app on my phone, and every now and then I play a game. I go to the Hot Global 100, and I just spin down the list of different countries' pop charts, like a roulette wheel, then land on one, kind of like throwing a dart at a map. I then pick the first track at the top of the chart, the first one that doesn't have explicit lyrics in it anyway. Recently, I landed on Guyana, and at number 3, this is what's grabbing a lot of attention, not just in Guyana, but across the Caribbean. Where will we go when this quarantine thing done and everybody touch road? This is Coffee, known to her family as Michaela Simpson. She's a Jamaican reggae singer and songwriter and came up with a simple tune called Lockdown. What happens when we get out of lockdown, she asks. And more personally, that guy who I started flirting with on FaceTime at the beginning of lockdown, the guy who said he didn't want a relationship. She wants to know how that's going to end up. If you love me, sings Coffee, you should let me know. And if you don't, better let me go. Here's Coffee with more of her unrequited love song hit for the pandemic. If you love me, you should let me, you should let me, you should let me know. And if you don't know, better feel let me, I better you let me go. Pulling up, pulling up, pulling up. Nobody deal with the bugger and talking. Me nothing now, we are chilling in an apartment. Hope you don't mind me asking, where will we go? Travel, we go whole valley. Say your hope in your love and not just no tally. Make my heart full of some love. New music from Jamaican singer Coffee. Lockdown is a song. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. During the pandemic, singing in a choir is a big no-no. But that's not stopping this Canadian high school music instructor from teaching Do Re Mi.
We have to be masked 3 meters away from each other, and then I personally have to be 6 meters away from the closest student.
Not ideal, perhaps, but music theory and scales can't stop, won't stop. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. China, Russia, and Cuba, three countries you probably do not think of when it comes to exemplary human rights records. But yesterday, these three were admitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Human rights activists have been vocal in opposing this. People like Hillel Neuer. He's the executive director of UN Watch, a Geneva-based NGO which monitors the United Nations. Hillel, what was your reaction to these three countries, China, Russia, and Cuba, getting seats on the UN Human Rights Council?
Well, I thought it was a black day for human rights at the United Nations. This is a body, the Human Rights Council, that was created with the express purpose of holding abusive regimes to account and defending the rights of individuals who suffer oppression and discrimination. And instead, the United Nations appointed some of the most notorious abusers of fundamental freedoms: Russia, which poisons dissidents; China, which silences whistleblowers who are trying to sound the alarm over the coronavirus; and then Cuba, which is a police state that's been existing for 6 decades, that likewise throws human rights activists in prison and journalists. The notion that these would be the world judges of human rights is absolutely shameful.
So back up for a moment and just help us understand, how does a system actually work at the council? How many members are there, and how do they get voted in?
The Human Rights Council is a 47-nation body. Countries serve for 3-year terms, and every year there's elections. They're staggered. So every year, about 15 countries go off and 15 countries go on. So we had the elections yesterday. And officially, the General Assembly member states are supposed to vote based on human rights considerations. And under the founding charter of the council, council members are obliged to uphold the, quote, highest standards in the promotion and protection of human rights. Yet notwithstanding those criteria, the sad, tragic reality is that countries at the UN typically allow politics to trump human rights principles. And in the end, the reason that China, Russia, Cuba were elected is because countries acted according to political considerations, not according to human rights principles.
Could you argue that by bringing these three countries, China, Russia, and Cuba, into the fold, it'll be kind of like human rights school and will, or potentially could, keep them more accountable?
One could argue that, but not credibly. It's not a credible argument. Sadly, it is a line that we hear at the United Nations by diplomats who are part of the system. I hear this argument. It may be the case for certain countries that have a problematic past and that are on a new journey towards a post-authoritarian system and has really committed to reform. But when Hugo Chavez and then Maduro of Venezuela were elected to the council again and again, did they learn and improve? Or on the contrary, did they throw more journalists, more judges, more opposition leaders in prison than ever before? When Vladimir Putin was elected again and again, as he was yesterday, did Russia learn and improve? Or on the contrary, did they invade more neighboring territories, drop more barrel bombs on Syria, and poison more dissidents than ever before? And the same goes with China.
So Hillel, the U.S. withdrew from the U.N. Human Rights Council in 2018. It said the council had failed in its mission. The Trump White House has backed away from a lot of U.N. programs. How significant is the U.S. absence from the council? And along with the admission of Cuba, Russia, and China now, what's it all mean for human rights globally?
Well, look, I think the U.S. and other democracies have a dilemma because the dictatorships are fighting hard to be there, and they are acting vigorously more than ever before to corrupt the ideas of individual human rights. So the U.S. took the approach to pull out. I understood why they did it. I disagreed with that approach. I testified before the Senate, before Congress, and said that actually those who are critics of the council, they should fight and be there and call out injustices.
Can you put just a few more details on that? If the UN Human Rights Council were to work the way you think it should, keeping nations accountable for human rights abuses globally, what does that look like?
Well, it means helping victims on the ground. At the end of the day, words do matter. They do send signals. Word is father to deed. And the Human Rights Council does not have the power of the purse. They don't have the power of the sword, but they do have the power to shame abusers. Let's not exaggerate it. If there's a genocide happening in Syria, the Human Rights Council has adopted many resolutions and they have commissions of inquiry, and that's all good and wonderful. I don't know if it saved a single person. So we shouldn't exaggerate the potential, but it can be one arrow in the quiver. It can be an additional tool in the toolbox. We need accountability. That means resolutions, commissions of inquiry, emergency sessions. We have a few of them today, but far too few. And I hold our democracies accountable. The fact that the European Union didn't say a word publicly that this was a bad thing. So I think there's a lot of fear and cowardice among our own democracies. We need to strengthen them. We need to demand that our democratic representatives use the Human Rights Council for what it should be, which is to speak out, defend, protect victims, dissidents, and hold abusive regimes to account in any way that they can.
Hillel Neuer, he's the executive director of UN Watch, a Geneva-based NGO which monitors the United Nations. Hillel, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
The NBA figured it out, but generally pro sports have had a rough go of it during the pandemic. In South Korea, soccer stadiums are limited to 25% capacity. Right here in my hometown, the Boston Marathon was canceled for the first time in its history. This past summer's Tokyo Olympics postponed until next year. In Mexico, though, one pro wrestling company is not giving up. Jose Guillen is an announcer with the AAA Wrestling Company.
This is totally new for the entire crew, for everybody. It's very special to have this new part of the traditional sport with the cars, with all the action of the wrestlers. I think it's fantastic today.
As the world's Jorge Valencia reports from Mexico City, they're organizing bouts of lucha libre at the drive-in.
Even if everyone's staying in their car, it's pretty rowdy out here. A few dozen drivers are parked around a wrestling ring. They pound their horns. They switch on their radios for the play-by-play. The announcers are just as excited as anyone.
Vámonos! La acción de Autolucha Triple A Worldwide!
There are five matches on this particular Saturday.
Máximo
is a muscular wrestler wearing a hot pink mohawk. Tito Santana is wearing black stripes on his face. And Mr. Iguana is crawling between cars. He's wearing a reptilian green suit. And like all Mexican lucha libre wrestlers, Mr. Iguana keeps his civilian identity to himself. But he later says that the fans yelling around him are the most important part of a fight.
It's almost like a 90%. The only 10% is your will and your soul to give it everything. So it's amazing when you hear it, when you hear the honking, then you get fired up.
Motivation aside, today is not the day for Mr. Iguana.
I couldn't get up because I got a chair shot to my face, so I was like knocked out.
A chair to your face?
Yep, chair shot in my head.
And yet, today is a victory for all the wrestlers carrying on Mexico's tradition of rough and extravagant lucha libre, which literally translates to free fighting. The Mexican government banned arena events across the country since the beginning of the pandemic, leaving thousands of wrestlers looking for work elsewhere. But one of the country's biggest wrestling companies, AAA, figured out a way to hold fights here in Mexico City beginning this month. Jose Manuel Guillen is one of the play-by-play announcers.
Autoluchas is a new way to make lucha libre here in Mexico. You can come on your car. You can see the matches in a big structure and to stay safe for all the pandemic situation.
Most wrestlers agree the experience doesn't compare to bouts in arenas. But as Guillen says, everything has changed in the new normal.
I don't know if all the people who are listening to us know that there's nothing impossible for the Mexicans.
And that's especially the case for a tradition so many here are so passionate about. Dania Rivas pulled up to the fights with her niece, her brother, and her sister-in-law. She explains, this isn't just a sport. Lucha libre is an art form and a part of Mexican culture, Rivas says. By the way, she's partial to the wrestlers who break the rules, so she was happy to see Mr. Iguana get knocked out with a chair to the face. Mexican culture is a culture of warriors, Rivas says. That's also why the country has so many boxing champions. Her brother, Cesar Mauricio Rivas, interrupts her. Mexicans are good at everything and power through, Cesar Mauricio says. And he adds, we're going to get through COVID, too.
Y este COVID, mira.
For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
The pandemic has changed everything. Working from home, professional sports without spectators, and Paula Ortelli's choir class.
Can I trust you not to sing? Okay. Great. Here we go. Butterfly.
Ortelli is a high school music teacher in Stratford, Ontario, up in Canada. She's teaching students to sing without actually singing. You can kind of hear them humming in the background. It's a scene that's playing out in high schools across Canada as teachers and students find creative ways to get around public health restrictions. Anita Elash visited the class by video cam, and she joins us on another piece of technology, FaceTime, from Toronto to tell me about it. So no singing in choir class because of the pandemic, obviously. Singing, you expel a lot of aerosolized coronavirus, potentially. What are the rules in Canadian schools, Anita?
Well, you're right. You know, singing is one of those activities that's been linked to coronavirus super spreader events. And back in early March, the members of a choir in Washington State contracted the virus after singing together, even though they had no physical contact. So the CDC says singing releases airborne particles that will carry the virus. And the same goes for playing wind instruments. That means that school boards and health officials in Canada have allowed hands-on music classes to go ahead, but students can't play wind instruments on school property or sing indoors. Mm. Paula Ortelli told me that at her school in Stratford, they can sing outdoors, but with some really strict parameters.
We have to be masked 3 meters away from each other, and then I personally have to be 6 meters away from the closest student. So
it lends itself to singing in a huge parking lot, which isn't the greatest for a vocal music class.
No, that does not sound great, but it sounds like Artelli is really trying. What are teachers like her doing to keep music programs in school up and running?
Well, music teachers across Canada have come up with all kinds of creative solutions. Ortelli decided that she'd rather teach indoors, so she's moved into a classroom and she has to follow some really strict rules. Everyone has to stay 6 feet apart and wear a mask. And since singing indoors is banned, the choral students learn their parts by humming and chanting. Then they all go home to practice on their own in front of a camera, and they play that back for the class later in the week. Now, the band students who'd normally play wind instruments like flutes and trombones and trumpets, now they've switched to ukuleles and percussion, things like drums, pails, and boom whackers.
Wow, just like back in the old days. What are they actually learning musically?
They're learning to appreciate music, which is an important part of the music curriculum. Paula Ortelli says that they're also developing really great rhythm. But she told me that the biggest challenge for her is watching her students hold themselves back when they're just dying to belt it out. They'll often tell her, "I wish I could sing," and that really gets to her.
Yeah, that is tough to hear for a music teacher, for sure. You were able to speak with some of the music students, Anita. What did you hear from them?
The students I talked to said they're just really happy to be back in class. Jerrica Archer, who's 17, told me that the pandemic has been stressful for her. And she said that if she couldn't take singing, she'd probably be having a really bad school year.
I love singing and stuff. So when I come here, I feel joy, I feel happiness. It makes me feel better as a person because the people around me are really great. So then just helps out a lot.
Anita, what's going to happen to music programs across Canada going forward?
It isn't clear, but surprisingly, music teachers are feeling quite optimistic. The thing is, public schools in Canada have been cutting back on arts programs over the last few years. And this summer, the Coalition for Music Education in Canada, which represents music teachers, wrote to every provincial health minister and education minister in the country. And they pointed out that people everywhere, all around the world, were relying on music to get them through the stress and uncertainty of the pandemic. And they argued that kids should get the same benefit. Eric Favreau, who's the head of the coalition, says it's a chance to reimagine how music could be taught.
I think music is going to come back stronger than ever. And mainly because the general public now understands the impact that music has on people's lives.
He says that's a big reason these improvised programs have gone ahead. And so now no one's talking about cutting music anymore.
Kind of sad it took a pandemic to realize that, but there we go. Reporter Anita Elash in Toronto, thanks very much for this.
It's good to talk to you, Marco. Thank you.
Music is alive and well at the Polish Embassy in Washington today. 12-year-old piano phenom Matthew Chang put on a virtual performance there to mark two important anniversaries, the 40th anniversary of Poland's Solidarity Movement, which helped end communism in the country, and the 210th anniversary of the birth of Polish composer Frédéric Chopin. Chang got a master class in playing Chopin over the summer with the chair of the piano department at Juilliard, Jerome Lowenthal.
So it's not...
Wow, it takes quite the trained ear to hear the difference there, let alone play it. Not an easy task for any pianist, age notwithstanding. The concert organizers say it's an effort to bring people together, unite them at least for a moment online during this global crisis. It's part of an ongoing series of concerts at embassies in Washington aimed at cultural exchange, letting people get the feel of a country through its music. Jerome Barry, concert series organizer, said, "Culture and the arts have the power to demonstrate that we have more in common than what divides us." No disagreement here. The U.S. election doesn't just affect us here in the U.S. The results will impact the entire planet. As part of our ongoing election coverage, today we're looking at the vote through the lens of LGBTQ rights.
The whole world is watching.
The most important election.
Human rights.
Climate change.
Race. Immigration.
Value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world.
Worldwide, the LGBTQ communities are fighting for a range of rights and protections. LGBTQ activists in the U.S. say the last 4 years here have seen some advancements, also some devastating setbacks. And they warn the U.S. is falling behind in the international fight for more support and less discrimination. Here's the world's Bianca Hillier with more.
Under the Obama administration, LGBTQ Americans won a number of long-fought battles.
If we want to be the global leader in combating HIV/AIDS, we need to act like it.
The gays and lesbians will soon be able to serve openly in the military.
We're going to prohibit all companies that receive a contract from the federal government from discriminating against their LGBT employees.
The court has ruled in favor of marriage equality.
That rich two-term track record was a radical change from previous presidents. According to Jessica Stern, the executive director of a nonprofit called Outright Action International.
The U.S. is a superpower, so its actions are watched by governments everywhere.
Stern says the tone set by the U.S. in the years leading up to 2016 signaled a step forward for LGBTQ Americans and for the global queer community. But
that changed when President Trump came into office.
Under the Trump administration, many queer advocates say the U.S. is falling behind other countries on LGBTQ issues, including the advancement of transgender rights.
The standard for gender identity recognition around the world is getting higher and higher, where governments are saying, let's interrogate the question of whether access to legal name change and gender marker change should be free and quick.
That's the global discourse the U.S. is failing to participate in, as the Trump administration blocks transgender people from serving in the military and tries to strip transgender people of discrimination protections. The U.S. is also behind on the global progress toward banning gay conversion therapy, the discredited attempt to change a person's sexual orientation.
Germany has now passed a nationwide ban on gay conversion therapy.
Gay conversion therapy will be banned by Labour if it's re-elected to government.
A bill to end conversion therapy in Canada.
Despite this international movement, the U.S. has no federal law or policy against the practice. And there are other ways President Trump has withdrawn from the international stage. In 2018, the U.S. left the UN's Human Rights Council, a move which advocates say endangered queer people around the globe. Julia Ehrt is the director of programs at the advocacy group ILGA World.
Thankfully, some of the Latin American and European states, you know, stepped up their efforts in supporting LGBTI rights, but the U.S. leaving the Human Rights Council has done some considerable damage.
Advocates say the U.S. presidential election is an opportunity to repair that damage and lead other countries to follow suit. But LGBTQ rights haven't been mentioned on a single debate stage this year, and supporters are pushing for queer issues to be included in foreign policy discussions.
How you treat people abroad is often how you treat people here at home.
That's Congresswoman Dina Titus, a Democrat from Nevada. Last summer, she introduced the GLOBE Act in the House of Representatives, which would ensure that the State Department's role of special envoy for the human rights of LGBT persons is codified into law. As it stands, the position has been vacant since 2017. Congresswoman Titus says the GLOBE Act would not only direct policy,
but as a symbol to the rest of the world that we take this seriously and we want to be a leader encouraging other countries to do the same.
For the record, according to Jessica Stern of Outright Action International, that's exactly what happened when the special envoy position was first announced in 2015.
I got an email that day from a high-ranking official in a foreign government who said, "We can't let the U.S. beat us on this. Now we're going to have to create the position, but make sure it has an even bigger budget." And I thought, like, wow, this is great. This is a race to the top.
The special envoy position in the U.S. is relatively new, but similar roles are tried and true around the world.
I can tell you that I am enthusiastically supportive to that type of measure.
Victor Madrigal-Borlos is the United Nations independent expert on sexual orientation and gender identity. He was appointed by the Human Rights Council, and one of his mandates is to suggest best practices that eradicate discrimination toward LGBTQ people. A special envoy role, as seen in Costa Rica, Canada, and across Europe, does the job.
I think it creates enormous energy for diplomatic and political conversation at the international level.
But Jessica Stern says the U.S.'s foreign policy on global LGBTQ rights wouldn't benefit from the envoy position if Trump wins re-election.
Under the Trump administration, it wouldn't have any meaning. It wouldn't be persuasive to foreign governments because as a prerequisite, you need to have LGBTI rights be respected at the domestic level. And in fact, there would be the fear that LGBTI rights were being used as though it were a symbol of what a human rights champion we are, when in fact it wouldn't be true.
The Trump administration did not reply to my request for comment, but the president's LGBTQ advisory board, Trump Pride, points to his commitment to decriminalize homosexuality where it's currently illegal.
And we stand in solidarity with LGBTQ people who live in countries that punish, jail, or execute individuals based upon sexual orientation.
Joe Biden's campaign also did not reply to my request for comment. His LGBTQ policy says Biden would, quote, immediately fill that special envoy position at the State Department, along with other measures to advance global LGBTQ rights.
Using religion or culture to discriminate against or demonize LGBTQ individuals is never justified, not anywhere in the world.
Decisions made by the next president of the United States will affect millions of queer people around the world. To those people, Victor Madrigal-Borlos from the UN says, pay attention.
Is there an intent to decriminalize in the case that criminalization exists? Is there an intent to eliminate all of the institutional drivers of discrimination, such as conversion therapy? How explicit are those policy formulations? That is the way that citizens can participate, scrutinizing actions and political intent and actually making up their minds in relation to them.
LGBTQ voters in the U.S. have largely made up their minds. According to a recent poll, 76% of queer voters support Biden, 17% support Trump, and just 2% remain undecided. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
And that's our show for the 14th of October. The World comes to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studio at GBH Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay healthy. We'll be back with you tomorrow.